MacCast, Monday, November 30th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, here we are at the end of the month. We just passed the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States, and that sort of reminded me that I probably don't tell you thank you enough for all that you do to support this show. We really wouldn't be here without you. So I am incredibly appreciative of the ability to each and every week sit down and record a podcast for you. And that's enabled by you subscribing to the feed, by you putting reviews into iTunes, by you sending me email and feedback and giving me ideas for things to cover on the show. It's enabled by our great sponsors and also you supporting those sponsors, as well as MacCast members and just all the bits and pieces. It's this great community that we have here, and I am really happy that I am able to make the MacCast and have been able to do that for the past 10 years. It's a lot of fun, and I look forward to continuing to do it. And I probably should say thank you in every episode, but that's not why we're here, right? We're here to talk about technology and Apple, but I really do feel it every time I sit down in front of the mic. I just think, wow, this is amazing that I get to do this, and it's because of you. So sincerely, thank you. Just wanted to say that right there at the top. All right, let's get into what we're going to be talking about today. A few things to talk about. There's not a ton going on. Apple has bought a new company. We're going to talk about that in a little bit here. Also, something happened with Apple Pay in Australia, and it's not really great news if you're down under. Also, some trouble in the UK, possibly, for iTunes and Apple Music. iPad Pro accessories on the positive side are starting to make their way into retail stores. Also, we're going to talk about Black Friday, of course, Thanksgiving holiday in the States. How did Apple do with selling stuff? Little hint, not too shabby. And also some news about Amazon Prime and Apple TV. Also, what's happening with maybe the next set of iPhones due out sometime next year. So we're going to talk about all that. We're also going to get back into some of your cable tips and tricks, talk a little bit about the iPad Pro Smart Keyboard, and also try and help out with some Wi-Fi issues, mobile backups, all that sort of thing. And it should be a lot of fun. But before we get into all of that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Hey, look, if you need to build a website, I can just say one word. I can say Squarespace. I say you should go there. And you probably need a website these days for almost anything that you do, right? Doesn't it seem like you want to do something? Say you're coaching your kids' sports team. They want to have a website. Maybe you are in a club or a group. You're involved in an organization, a school. Need a website. Maybe you want to start up a small business or a side business, or maybe you just want to show off your pets or your kids or your vacation photos or talk about your travel or blog or any of that, right? It all requires a website. And you could go out, you could hire a programmer, you could work with designers, you could do all of that stuff. But that's a lot of work. You could also do it yourself. You could maybe learn to code. There's great things online. You can figure that out. But really, who has time for that? This is where Squarespace comes in. Heck, I am a web developer. I've used Squarespace myself to build sites because sometimes you just need to get a site up there quickly. You need to have it done looking professional, looking great. Squarespace can let you do that without a lot of hassle. And they provide everything end to end. You can get the hosting, you can get the domain name, you can get all the tools you need to build your website. I've even recommended it to some of my clients. So that can give you an idea of how good these things are. They are professionally designed and they work regardless of your skill level. There's no coding required. But what I really appreciate is if you want a deep dive, if you want to get in there, they have all of the tools for that as well. And you can go as simple or as complex as you need. It grows with you. So if you just need a one-page site, they have this thing called cover pages that are perfect for that. And I have a lot of clients who come to me, they're like, I just need a one-page site. Hey, go to Squarespace. You can throw it up. You can have it up in 5 minutes. I mean, it's that easy. And then when you want to get more complicated, if you need e-commerce, they have tools for that. You need galleries, blogs. You want to put a map. You want to integrate social media. It is all in there. And a lot of it is simple drag and drop tools. You do a little configuration and it's affordable. Pricing starts at just $8 a month and you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. You can try it for free. No credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/Maccast. And when you decide to sign up, here's a great deal for Maccast listeners. Squarespace is going to give you 10% off your first purchase with the coupon code Maccast. That's MACCAST. Just go to squarespace.com/Maccast. You can check it all out. And a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the show. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about this company that Apple acquired this week. It's an interesting acquisition, a company called Faceshift. When they were asked about the purchase, Apple's confirmation came in the form of its typical canned response. So this story kind of came out, I think TechCrunch, somebody rang up Apple, said, hey, did you buy this company called Faceshift? And of course, Apple said, well, Apple buys smaller technology companies from time to time. And generally, we do not discuss our purpose or plans. So not really a confirmation, I would say, that they bought the company. But in Apple speak, that is a confirmation. So when you see that, that's what's going on. And also TechCrunch reported that some of Faceshift's staff in Europe are now listed as Apple employees, I think, over on LinkedIn. So pretty much Apple acquired this company. And why? What does this company do? Faceshift technology is used in movies, in the game industry. It's actually being most recently used in, or has been most recently used in, animating faces of CGI characters in the upcoming Star Wars movie. Hey, we're just about 3 weeks from Star Wars, by the way. Just a side note, I'm totally excited about the new Star Wars Force Awakens movie. So they use this technology in that movie. And basically, it's stuff that lets you do facial motion capture without having to stick all those little dots on your face. They've developed technologies where they can capture points and do depth maps and get movements and expressions to make really expressive avatars or facial motions and things like that. And you might be thinking, what kind of application does Apple have for that? And we really don't know at this point what Apple wants to use the technology for. All we can really do is speculate. Apple has acquired a couple other companies that seem to be in related fields. If you remember, they bought a company called Mateo, an augmented reality company, and also the motion tracking company PrimeSense, which was, remember, we thought Apple might put motion sensors into the Apple TV, you know, kind of like they had in the Xbox or the PlayStation to capture your movements through a camera, that kind of stuff. So they're pulling together these different technologies, and it looks like they might be doing some stuff with maybe virtual reality, motion tracking, gaming. So there's gaming applications. There's maybe some potential applications for Apple's car project. For the facial stuff, maybe they want to integrate security, or something cool would be auto login. So the EyeSight camera or an upgraded camera on your Mac might be able to detect your face and simply know when you sit down on the computer at the computer, hey, that's you. I can automatically log you in. Facial recognition in photos to better tag and organize your photos. So there's a lot of various places I think Apple could and probably will apply this technology. I don't think it's just going to be in one area. And I think there could be even some fun things just like in FaceTime to be able to change your appearance or maybe mask an animal face over your own face and have it move naturally and still give the expressions that you would give if you were doing a FaceTime conversation with someone. So it's going to be interesting to see what Apple does with this company. But right now, there's just a lot of speculation. But it seems like cool technology, and I look forward to seeing how Apple integrates it. So far, Apple has rolled out their Apple Pay payment technology in the United States. in the UK, and then most recently in Canada and Australia. But if you've been following this, the Australian and Canadian rollouts were somewhat limited. They rolled it out for American Express customers only, and it's sounding like, at least in Australia, for those who don't have bank-issued Amex cards. I'm not even sure bank-issued Amex cards are a thing, but I read that in one of the reports that I looked through. And now the rumors are that Australian banks are kind of holding up the rollout of Apple Pay to Visa and MasterCard, that they are not happy with the terms and basically are not signing up or signing on to the Apple Pay program. Now, as near as I can tell, I'm trying to understand this. I'm not a finance person, but I'll give you my best attempt. In the US, it sounds like what's going on is when you make a credit card purchase, the banks get a 1% commission on that. And in Australia, the commission's different. It's about half that amount, so about 0.5%. The trouble is that with Apple Pay coming into the mix, Apple wants a part of the transaction as well. So Apple wants a little piece of that pie, and it's basically going to come out of the bank's own commission. It's a fee that Apple takes from the banks. And what Apple is saying they want is for every $100 in sales, they get 15 cents. And it's not adjusted based on the percentage that actually the bank collects. So if you look at how the system works in the US, for every $100 in sales, the bank is going to get $1, and then Apple wants 15 cents of that. So that's net 85 cents for the bank. But because Australian banks only get 0.5%, they're only getting 50 cents for every $100 in sales. And if Apple takes their 15 cent cut out of that, that means an Australian bank would only get 35 cents now. So it's a significant difference. And because it's not just based on a percentage from Apple's side, it's actually a set amount, the deal isn't working out. And they want Apple to lower their commission because basically the card companies don't have as good a deal, or the banks don't have as good a deal with the card companies as they do with the ones in the US. And they're saying, okay, that's not fair. You need to adjust your rates. And Apple has been pretty hardlined about this amount of money that they want to get from Apple Pay transactions, at least from the stuff that I've been reading. And apparently another stumbling block is that, unlike in the US, Australia already has a pretty robust mobile payment system with a number of existing solutions. So the banks are also arguing, hey, we really don't need Apple Pay. Our customers already have mobile payment solutions, and this is just another choice, but we have a lot of choices, so you don't need it. And that, apparently, this week we're hearing, is not going over well with everybody in Australia. Specifically, a spokesman at the Labour Party, they're suggesting that the banks refusing to adopt Apple Pay could be interpreted by some as anti-competitive behavior. Specifically, they said, quote, Australian consumers should not be denied the ability to make payment choices that are openly available to consumers globally. And I definitely get where they're coming from. I think we all like to have choice in our payment platforms. I mean, you've heard me complain on this show about the fact that more retailers don't take or accept Apple Pay, and I'd like to have more choice there. I can't even imagine how frustrating it is for an Apple fan in Australia who really wants to use Apple Pay at all and not being able to do it yet, or being limited to only an American Express card. We're also seeing limits on things like, I can't use my business credit card for Apple Pay. So how the banks and the credit card companies are sort of dividing it up is, I think, slowing the rollout and making things more difficult. But getting back to Australia, I understand not having the choice is frustrating. I don't know that it could be interpreted as totally anti-competitive behavior, especially since some of the issues come back to the negotiations between Apple and the banks, right? If Apple will give in a little bit or adjust their fee structure, then they could get into the Australian market in a broader way. So who really knows what's going on in the negotiations and behind closed doors? I also have a feeling that Apple is making some concessions in places like China. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit because they're working on getting Apple Pay into China because of how their markets are. So, you know, I think it goes deal by deal, and the Australian banks are playing a little bit of hardball, and that might be just what they have to do to get Apple to kind of come down a little bit. But we'll see how all of this plays out. I don't think it's going to ultimately be ruled as anti-competitive, but I'm not really up on Australian consumer laws and protections and things like that. I'm also suspecting that, you know, another thing that Apple could push is that their solution may have some more security and privacy advantages over some of the other current choices. Again, I'm not familiar with what you have in Australia right now, but that's one of the big features of Apple Pay, is the ability to bring things like fingerprint security to your credit card data, and more importantly, data protection, you know, data not being shared and personal information not being shared with the retailers. And I think a lot of consumers would like that choice as well. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. If you're in Australia and you have some opinions on this, please share them with us. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But of course, Apple wants to expand Apple Pay globally, and they're really working on this. We got news this week, too, that Apple may be getting pretty close to getting Apple Pay rolled out into China. There's reports of a tentative agreement with China UnionPay that would open up Apple Pay, or specifically 5 million NFC point of sale terminals in the region to Apple Pay. But that's only one side of actually what is needed. The deal isn't signed yet, apparently, because, again, they need bank support. And once again, the fees are a sticking point. You know, Apple wants their 15 cents, but China banks get even less of a percentage of the transaction than Australia, just 0.4%. So still some negotiations to work through, but UnionPay and Apple are reportedly looking to launch Apple Pay in China sometime in 2016. So hopefully they can get all this stuff worked out, and we'll get more Apple Pay in Australia, China, and then they can move on to even more countries. Some changes to the UK intellectual property laws are causing concerns for some Apple fans, specifically those of us who like Apple Music and iTunes, and we like using those services. The UK Intellectual Property Office announced a decision recently that they are abandoning a private copying exception that has been in place in the UK since October of 2014. Basically, a thing that allowed you to make personal copies of content, say, on a CD that you owned, or, for example, unlock it in an online locker service like Apple Music. Now, their decision apparently was prompted by the High Court declaring that the exemption was illegal, and this happened back in July, but it's causing a lot of confusion and concern, and really, what does it actually mean? Well, it now means basically that in the UK, it's probably going to be illegal to format shift your personal music. The old exemption allowed you to duplicate copyrighted material for personal use, and that's the thing that is being apparently thrown out. So if this is true, it could put not only consumers in a bind, but it also could put Apple in a somewhat odd position, specifically with respect to things like iTunes Music Match and Apple Music, because it would make the ability to rip CDs, a feature that's in iTunes, basically illegal. So would Apple be able to allow, or would they be allowed to give that capability to consumers, basically enabling them to break the law? Would it have to be ripped out? It's not really clear at this point. Also, iTunes Music Match, that gives you access to copies of music that you own in iTunes in the cloud. That would potentially be illegal because it's another copy. Also, the matching part of Apple Music, which falls kind of in the same realm. And then also, just having more than one copy of a song that you own could be problematic. So if you've got a song or a CD on your Mac, or something that you purchased, rather, it would have to be, because you can't rip a track onto your Mac anymore. So say it was something you purchased in the iTunes store, you purchased it on your Mac, you wouldn't be able to essentially copy that same file over to an iPhone or get another copy of it. You would have to pay again And if you didn't, it sounds like you could potentially be in violation. Not good, right? Really not good for Apple. For individual users, though, what I'm reading is it's unlikely that the UK government would actively go after anybody. So it's not like suddenly overnight everybody's going to be a criminal or the police are going to be out looking for people who have ripped music into iTunes. But for sure, music services who wanted to continue to operate in the UK are likely going to have to follow along with the laws. And that could mean Apple having to make significant adjustments or changes to its products and services surrounding music and digital content in the UK. And that could be kind of a pain for Apple and other companies. Of course, this doesn't just affect Apple. It would affect, I would assume, services like Spotify and some of the other things that are out there. So it's really confusing. And I'm going to be kind of trying to follow along with this, hopefully with some of your help, especially those of you who are in the UK and in the EU, because I think this expands even out beyond the UK borders at some point. But between this and the other bill that's been proposed, the Investigatory Powers Bill, this is the one where the UK doesn't want end-to-end encryption, like the stuff found in the iPhone, to exist, or they want a backdoor, something that's also being proposed in the US, by the way, and being fought. But it sounds like the UK is a little further along. They have this bill proposed that would make it illegal to have the kind of end-to-end encryption that iPhones and other electronic devices and services have. Between that and this music thing, it's sounding like the UK is becoming an increasingly kind of hostile environment for a company like Apple. And it's going to be interesting, to say the least, to see how this all plays out and how Apple reacts. I mean, does Apple just pull out of selling products and services in the UK entirely? Do they make adjustments that could be very costly? Do they get in there and start lobbying and work to adapt or change these laws and bills and things? Will we get another exemption? Will we get some changes? I think a little bit of everything is going to be happening. Hopefully not Apple pulling out, but more Apple maybe changing some of their products and services or adjusting them. And more importantly, sort of fighting to and lobbying and working with the government to kind of get laws that make sense and can kind of make some compromises on some of this stuff. But right now, it's not sounding too great. I'd still love to hear from you if you're in the UK. What do you think of this stuff? It sounds kind of crazy to me. So I don't know. Well, let's move on to some happier news. Why don't we? If you are an iPad Pro owner and you've been waiting on your accessories, the Apple Pencil and the Smart Keyboard, it's sounding like over the holiday weekend, things got a little bit better, at least in Apple retail stores here in the States. I think also in the UK and some other regions, more availability, at least of the Apple Pencil. And now some stores are even reporting having Apple Smart Keyboard inventory. If you look at the online ship times, they still seem to be between 4 to 5 weeks. But I had more than a couple reports over the weekend from MacCast listeners who were able to purchase or at least saw the accessories in an Apple retail store. On my side of things, I finally received my original shipments, my original orders that I put in on November 11th of both my Apple Pencil and Smart Keyboard. Those arrived on Friday, and I have had some time to play around with the Apple Smart Keyboard, so I'll give you my review of that. I've already talked to you about the Apple Pencil because I bought one from an Apple retail store, and I've been playing with that. I still absolutely love it. I think it's an amazing accessory, and it really makes drawing on the iPad just incredibly fun and incredibly natural. But go back and listen to the previous episode of the MacCast where I really got into the Apple Pencil. But basically, Smart Keyboard's here. That means that iFixit got their hands on one of them, and they did what they do. They tore it apart. They ripped it apart. It wasn't easy. They had to basically destroy it, cut it apart, because it's really well put together. It is solidly built. Not very repairable, though, as you'll hear from their repairability score. But they did note some interesting technologies in there. One really cool thing is that it doesn't have any kind of ribbon cables or connectors in there, not in the traditional sense. What they have is apparently a conductive fabric inside that makes all of the connections for sending and receiving data. That means it's going to have more durability. You're not going to have wires that can potentially break. I also think it probably adds a lot to the thinness. They also say that the exterior fabric seems to be extremely water and stain resistant, and there's really no holes. So if you're going to spill on it, it's pretty much spill proof. You're not going to have issues. You can wipe it off. It's going to be durable and rugged, something you definitely want in that kind of product. They had to cut through several protective layers to actually get at the components. The keys themselves, they noted, were the same dome switches that are found in the 2015 Retina MacBook Pro. And I can attest that actually typing on it, while you're doing that on a hard surface, and I guess I'm giving away a little bit of my review, it does feel pretty natural. It feels like you're kind of clicking on a real keyboard that's built into a MacBook or is, you know, Apple's desktop keyboard. It feels pretty close. So that's good. But overall, iFixit gave the smart keyboard a repairability score of 0 out of 10. You're not going to be changing any components in it or fixing if a key breaks. You're pretty much looking at getting a new keyboard. There's no way to kind of repair that yourself. And it's not looking like Apple would probably be able to repair it either. And now that more of the accessories are hitting the streets, we're also seeing developers do some pretty interesting things and unexpected things with specifically the Apple Pencil. There was a developer, Hamza Sood, who made the Apple Pencil do things that it was never really intended to do. He jailbroke his iPad to be able to do this, but once he did, he was able to use the Apple Pencil's pressure sensor and take the data from it, interpret that, and translate it into 3D touch, basically running it through the 3D touch APIs, making it seem like the iPad actually had a 3D touch screen, and he was able to activate both the peak and pop features within the Apple Notes app. He posted a video of him doing it, and the iPad Pro screen does not have 3D touch capability, so all of that was coming through the sensor built into the Apple Pencil. So that could have, I think, some pretty cool applications if Apple would open that kind of technology up. Could you imagine in a drawing app being able to tap on different tools and controls and then based on pressure, maybe activate additional functionality or additional menu options, things like that? It could be really, really neat. And I think there could be applications in games. There could be all kinds of various applications where you could take the pencil and use pressure gestures to do different interactions. So hopefully Apple takes a look at that. And if they weren't already thinking about it, maybe starts to think about those potential applications. And then another developer, Simon Gladman, actually used the Apple Pencil's pressure sensor to kind of create a scale. Now, do you remember the Plum-O-Meter scale project that was done with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, where they were able to use the 3D sensors to kind of weigh various objects? He basically used the same principle, reversed it around, built a little special rig that kind of sat on top of the Apple Pencil and created this harness where he could weigh different items and then interpret the data. Again, this was all done through jailbreaking and hacking and private APIs, so not anything that could be commercially released or put into an actual iOS app, but cool to see nonetheless. Now, the scale wasn't incredibly accurate, but it was very sensitive, which kind of seems to imply in my mind that the pressure sensitivity on the Apple Pencil is pretty good in terms of the number of levels. Apple hasn't said how many, but I can tell you from using it that it seems very responsive to the lack of or the amount of pressure that you're applying to it, specifically within several different applications that I've tested. Certainly better than any of the Bluetooth styluses that are out on the market. So I'm impressed by the Apple Pencil. It didn't surprise me that it turned out when he was doing the little scale tests that it was incredibly sensitive. But a couple cool things that are being done with the Apple Pencil, whether or not it'll turn into anything that we actually get to see and play around with in a released application, who knows? That's all going to be in Apple's court at this point. But if you didn't catch those videos, you can find them online and check them out. So this past Thursday, Friday was what's commonly known as Black Friday, the time of year when, basically my inbox gets flooded with a bunch of spam emails from retailers doing various offers. Everybody's trying to get me to go to a mall that I want to be nowhere near. People are fighting over the one special deal TV and getting crazy. Yeah, I'm not a big fan, but I understand this is the time of the year when a lot of people like to be out shopping. They like to try and get the good deals on great stuff. And the good news for us Apple fans is that Apple apparently has made out pretty well, or at least iOS devices made a pretty good dent or showing in their ability to actually place orders for those deals. We got some data from Kastora of 200 online retailers and over 500 million shoppers on Thanksgiving Day. And they say that 78.3% of mobile online orders were made using an iOS device, an iPhone or an iPad. They also noted that overall online shopping for Thanksgiving grew by 12.5% year over year. So it was up. But despite the numbers being good for Apple, it was a slight slip from last year of 1.6%. Last year, 79.9% of mobile online purchases made on Thanksgiving were done on an Apple device. But still, the numbers are good, and they seem to reinforce one of Apple's favorite claims, and that is that despite any market share numbers or sales data on iOS devices, that Apple's customers tend to use their devices more often and for more things than owners of competing devices. And this one particular statistic does seem to back that claim up. Again, you know me, I'm always careful with statistics because it's easy to kind of bend the numbers or just find the numbers that you want to find to prove your point. But still, it's a good showing for Apple, and it relates to what was going on this week. Now, moving to something maybe a little more significant, a little bigger picture, the iPad Pro, it looks like, is actually doing what Apple wanted it to do, which is kind of turn around or at least give a little lift to revenue, iPad revenue, moving forward. We know that iPad sales have been slumping and that, you know, while Apple makes a healthy profit on iPads, it's become a smaller and smaller part of their overall revenue numbers each quarter. Well, Amit Daryanani of RBC Capital is now predicting that the iPad Pro could generate about $2.4 billion in revenue for Apple in the first 3 months of sales. And that is based on his theory that Apple has sold or will sell about 3 million iPad Pros in those first 3 months. And to put that in a little bit of perspective, if they do hit that revenue figure, that would mean that the iPad Pro had generated about half the total revenue that Apple earned back in March for all of its iPad sales. So it would account for about 50% of iPad revenues, which is pretty good. And while Daryanani's number might be a little bit higher than some other analysts, it's in the ballpark. KGI put their total sales estimate slightly lower at about 2.5 million units. But the point on iPad Pro is it has a higher average selling price. And I think we talked about that on possibly the last episode. And that just means more revenue. And that's really where it's going to help with Apple's iPad numbers come the next quarterly results call. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, but so far it looks like the iPad Pro is actually doing pretty well. There may be some good news for you if you picked up a new Apple TV over the holiday shopping weekend and you're an Amazon Prime customer who wants to watch Amazon Prime Video on that new Apple TV. If you remember a couple weeks ago, it was looking kind of grim because Amazon has had this tenuous relationship with Apple. And one of the things they did recently was remove all Apple TV and Chromecast products from their website. They did this last month because they claim the devices didn't offer Prime Video apps, and that might cause some confusion, quote unquote, for Amazon customers. I don't really buy that. I think they were trying to push their own Fire TV products, but he said, she said, we said, who knows? We'll just leave it at that. But the good news now is it sounds like Amazon may be bringing a Prime Video app to the Apple TV. If they do, it'll be interesting to see if they start selling Apple TVs on Amazon again. But we're getting this information based on a response to some feedback that a customer made on Amazon and then tweeted about. The guy's name is Dan Boston Weeks, and he claims that an Amazon support rep responded to his email feedback and said that the Amazon Instant Video app is in the works for the Apple TV. The response even gave a time frame of saying it would be available within a few weeks. What is a few weeks? I think that's somewhat up to interpretation. But if it's true, that's some pretty good news. I'm an Amazon Prime customer, and I'd love to be able to watch that video content on my Apple TV. Right now, the only way you can really do it is to use the Amazon Video for iOS app and then AirPlay it to your Apple TV. But having an app, a native app right there on the set-top box would be really nice. And it's something that a lot of people wanted, so sounds like it is coming. So what changed? Why didn't Amazon have the app out there day one? I think they, again, didn't really want to support Amazon Prime Video on Apple TV. They wanted all of us to go buy a Fire TV. But I think they're having to give in to the Apple TV's growing market share. Amazon really wants to sell more stuff. They want to sell more Amazon Prime accounts, and having Amazon Prime Video on Apple TV is going to help them do that. They're producing their own shows now. They want to get more eyeballs for that. And there are a lot of customers and a lot of Apple TVs out in living rooms around the world. As a matter of fact, for the third quarter of 2015, a strategy analytics report says that Apple TV now has 20% of the global digital media streamer market. Now, keep in mind, this 20% is a statistic from last quarter. So this was before the new Apple TV was released. And I have a feeling a lot of people, just based on the feedback I've been getting and even from my non-techie friends asking about the new Apple TV, a lot of people are picking these up, and a lot more people are going to pick up Apple TVs over the holiday season. But that number, that 20%, puts Apple TV in second place behind the Chromecast with 45% of the digital streamer market. Roku is in third place with 16%. I think they actually do have an Amazon Video app on the Roku boxes. And then I assume the Fire TV is in the other category, which was at 13%. So Apple's in second place in digital media streamers, and I think moving up on Chromecast, I think they're going to find it hard to offset the 45%, but they're going to get closer, and it's probably going to be at the expense of Roku and Fire TV. So once again, Amazon wants to get more eyeballs on their service. They're going to have to support Apple TV. So we could get it here in a couple weeks. Watch your software section, I guess, on your Apple TV to see when that happens. Or just listen to the MacCast. We'll talk about it as soon as it hits. Also, in case you missed it, just one other little bit of Apple TV news. Apple also added some new categories for apps on the Apple TV. They added education, health and fitness, lifestyle, news, and sports. So when you go into the store, you can find those in the categories section. These were added in addition to the games and entertainment categories that they already had, bringing the total number of categories up to 7. I still see a problem, though. You go in there, and it's the same kind of format. They kind of have a couple of rows of, like, featured applications and some highlighted applications, but there still is no way to really kind of browse or do any natural discovery. You either have to see a featured app, or you have to know the name of it and specifically do a search for it to find it. I've had to, you know, find some pretty significant apps that way, or go through the purchase section within my account. I guess that's the third way to do it. But really, browsing apps on the Apple TV, I didn't think they could take what was in iTunes or in the App Store and make it worse. but somehow they succeeded with the new Apple TV. It's probably my one major complaint about the Apple TV. Everything else has been great. I love the Siri search. I love games. I love a bunch of the other features, but that is an area I hope Apple puts a little attention to for the next major update of tvOS. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about the next generation iPhone. There is a rumor resurfacing. This is definitely not a new rumor, but it's definitely making a comeback this week that Apple may be looking for the next iPhone to get rid of the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. This report surfaced on the Japanese site Mac Attackara, and it's claiming that Apple wants to make the new iPhone 7 even thinner than the current 6S and 6S Plus. And in order to do that, we've got to get rid of the 35 millimeter headphone jack. It's just not, it's too thick, right? It's, you just don't have the physical space to do both. So they're saying that if they do that, they're going to be left with two options, either going Bluetooth or using the Lightning connector to attach headphones. They also claim that Apple may be updating the EarPods that are in the box to be Lightning EarPods, so they would connect via the Lightning connector. You just have the one connector cable on the iPhone for charging, for syncing, for doing everything through the single connector. They claim that Apple will add a digital to audio converter functionality in there, so presumably you could get a Lightning to analog 3.5 millimeter adapter if you wanted to use your standard wired headphones. It doesn't say, but I assume if they did have an adapter, if Apple even made one, it would be sold separately. And my guess at the price point, $20, right? US, that seems to be how Apple likes to price their adapters. Maybe even 29, but I don't think they could get away with that with a headphone adapter. But it's just an odd report, and I think one that is frustrating or concerning a lot of people, because a lot of people really like their headphones. They have certain kinds that they like. We've had that standardized connector for years and years, and not putting that in there by default is going to kind of make it feel like we're back in the days of, remember the original iPhone when you had the curved connector and it was kind of recessed, or I guess it was a recessed connector. It wasn't curved. It was recessed in there so that it didn't stick out on the curve, right? But only certain headphones would fit. Apple's headphones would fit, but a lot of standard headphone jacks wouldn't fit in there, and we all had to run around with these little adapters. Yeah, it's going to feel like that all over again. That would be weird, wouldn't it? I don't really like this idea. Mac Rumors, though, did note that back in June of 2014, Apple did add specifications to its Made for i program that allowed third-party manufacturers to actually make Lightning-based headphones. But so far, it seems like Philips is the only company that's even made any, so they really haven't taken off. I don't know if this is Apple's plan to kind of push that forward and get more Lightning-based headphones out there. I would assume if Apple does this, that Beats would get Lightning versions of their headphones, but I really don't know how I feel about this. I don't think we need a thinner iPhone. Haven't we gotten thin enough? I'm kind of okay with it. And we talked about this on the iOS show. You know, just leave it alone and put more battery in there. If you've got a little more space, we'll take more battery and keep our 3.5 millimeter jack. We don't need, to lose that. And wouldn't Lightning headphones potentially also have more of a power draw or a power drain on the headphone jack? Maybe they wouldn't. I don't know the technology. Definitely we'd end up with more adapters, something that I don't want. You're not going to be able to charge and use your headphones at the same time. That feels weird unless they're going to give us some kind of Y splitter. I don't know. I think, and I said this on the iOS show, I don't want Apple to do this. I want to be very clear about this. I don't want them to do this, but it seems like if they want to go thinner and they want to get rid of the headphone port, that they could just force the issue and say, look, we're going to support Bluetooth headphones for connecting to the iPhone. We're going to go all wireless and not have any other audio connector. And that would impact a ton of things very negatively. A lot of microphone devices go through that 3.5 millimeter jack. But again, we can plug mics in through the Lightning to USB adapter, like a USB mic. So there's already a solution for that. You know, I don't know, forget the connector altogether. And that's somewhat rhetorical because there are many options, again, like I said, that are not Bluetooth. There's a lot of people that like high-end audiophile headphones that aren't going to be able to go through a Bluetooth connection. Bluetooth connections tend to be unreliable. They're not great. Again, I don't think Apple's going to go that route, but this idea of using the Lightning connector, I don't think is the right solution. I think you're going to have a lot of unhappy customers if you go forward with that, but that's what's being rumored at this point. Another thing being rumored for next generation iPhones is OLED displays, the switch from LCD to OLED displays. There's varying dates on this. Some are saying Apple's been targeting trying to do this in 2017. Others are saying it's looking more like it's going to be 2018. It seems a heck of a ways off to be talking about, but you know, it's rumors, right? They start to come in early. This time around, the source is Nikkei. The speculation is that Apple has been looking into OLED technology for the iPhone for a while, but more recently in a significant enough way that LG Display, a current Apple supplier, has made plans to actually expand their OLED manufacturing capabilities. It's going to take them a while to get that up and running, which is why the timeline is maybe a little bit in flux. In fact, they're actually looking at gearing up or ramping up two factories in South Korea. In the past, it's believed part of the reason Apple hasn't switched yet is quality and yield issues. Apple needs a lot of displays when they're making iPhones, and they need the quality to be at a certain level. They're pretty demanding about things. And so it's believed they would actually, if they go to OLED, that even LG Display wouldn't be able to supply all of the displays that Apple needs. Apple would need to use another supplier. That's probably going to be Samsung. So all of this, building new factories, finding new suppliers, ramping up quality and all of these things point to it really not happening maybe until 2018. Apple wants to do it in 2017, but it's going to be really hard for the suppliers to spin up new factories and work out all of those production issues. And Apple does need like 200 million units a year, at least, probably more. And that is just a ton of displays. So the switchover is expected to happen. It's probably going to happen gradually. Some are saying not every iPhone will move over to OLED. It might just be the higher end models moving to the OLED technology and LEDs being in maybe the entry level models, something like that. And this gradual switchover could happen again, maybe as early as 2017, but probably not until 2018. We still have to get through 2016, so I don't even know why we're talking about this now. But hey, it was in the news this week, so we're going to cover it. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Want to get to some of your feedback regarding cable protection tips and tricks. We've been talking about this the last couple episodes. I had a listener who called in and talked about the quality of Apple's cables and how things like the connectors on EarPods and the connectors on Lightning cables and even connections and connectors on MacBook power supplies tend to break over the years. And I think, you know, we've had this debate back and forth. It depends on how rough you are on your cables or maybe not rough on your cables. But even myself, I've had a couple issues where a cable just fails at that little connector point, and I'm pretty gentle on my cables, so it definitely does happen. And last week, I think we got an email from a listener who said, hey, those things are covered under Apple Care. If you have that situation happen, take your AirPods, your Lightning cable, your even your MacBook Pro power adapter into Apple, and they'll replace it. And I never even thought to try that because I just figured those things were not covered. But I've received confirmation from many of you that you do get your cables replaced under AppleCare. So if you have AppleCare, specifically AppleCare Plus, go in there. And if you have a damaged cable, not one that your cat has chewed through, because that is not covered. They do not cover, you know, user damage. But if it's just normal wear and tear, normal usage, and you've been, you know, gentle on your cables, sounds like Apple might just give you a new one. And that can save you, you know, quite a bit of money. A good Lightning cable, $15-$20. A new set of headphones in that same sort of range, earbuds at least. And if you're talking about a Mac book power adapter, those things can be $80, $100. So it's worth a shot, and you'll probably just save some money. So I'm glad somebody let me know about that, because I had no idea. This is another thing I love about the MacCast community. I learn stuff each and every week on each one of these shows. So thanks for sharing that information with us. I also received an email from George. He sent me some pictures, and I'll have these up on the MacCast Flickr account. It's flickr.com/themaccast. And I'll also have a link to him in the show notes at maccast.com. But he uses this technique of creating kind of a loose loop with his MacBook power cable, not one, you know, that's really tight. So it's not like a knot, but just a loop on one end, on the end near the little cable adapter or the power brick. And then what he does is he wraps that around one of the little cable wrap prongs just far enough from the end to keep that little portion that sticks out of the brick from bending at an extreme angle. That's one thing I'm always really careful about when I'm wrapping up my cable, is I've seen people that just crank that over to one side, and it really puts a lot of strain on that point. And that's where I've seen that power cable can kind of fail or crack, and then you have an issue. But if you can keep that nice and straight, then you won't run into that kind of problem. And George's little technique seems to work for that. I looked at it. I'm a little concerned. I don't like kind of wrapping even my cables that tightly. But he said he's done it for years and it works on his stuff. And he's never had an issue with a MacBook cable. So take a look at that technique and see if that's something that might work for you. And then lastly, a couple of you commented on third-party products that you can get that just reinforce the ends of those cables around those connectors. I actually bought a set of these on Amazon. I think they were like $6. They're these little clips that go over the end and just extend and reinforce that area. You can also kind of do the DIY thing, do-it-yourself thing. And I think I mentioned this in a prior show, but I'll mention it again, and I'll have a link to an example in the show notes at maccast.com. But there's this product called Shugru, I think that's how you say it, S-U-G-R-U, and it's like this moldable plastic stuff, and it starts out soft, kind of like Play-Doh, and it stays soft, but it gets a little bit firmer as it hardens, basically into kind of like a plastic material, and you can use it to do all kinds of little repairs and things like that. People have used it to repair their MacBook, frayed MacBook power cables and adapters, and you just basically wrap it around there and sort of reinforce, again, the little tail end that comes out of the power brick or the end that comes out of the connection to the little MagSafe connector. Just wrap a little bit of this stuff around it, kind of strengthens that part of the cable. So take a look at that, and thanks to everybody who sent in all these tips and tricks about protecting the Apple cables. As I mentioned earlier, I finally received my iPad Pro Apple Smart keyboard, and I want to share a couple of my little early thoughts. I just got it on Friday, so I haven't had a chance to use it extensively, but I have been using it since Friday, and I think my initial impression is that I like it a lot. If you heard my sort of review or mini review or comments about the Logitech Create keyboard, which was the only one available at launch, I've been using that, but I really felt, for me personally, it was just a little bit too bulky. It is a great keyboard. I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression there. If you like your MacBook keyboard or your MacBook Pro keyboard, it feels almost identical. It has backlighting. My big issue with it, though, is that it adds quite a bit of bulk to the iPad Pro. And one of the reasons I want to have an iPad as my primary mobile computing platform is because of the thinness, because of the lightness. I'm trying to get away from the bulk of, say, a MacBook. I could go to something like a MacBook Air, but as you've heard me talk about, I really like the whole iOS ecosystem and prefer to have that be my mobile operating system of choice. So I'm trying to see if the iPad Pro can be my main mobile computing platform. And to that end, I really wanted Apple's Smart Keyboard because it is great. It is incredibly thin. It's a lot lighter than the iPad plus Logitech Create keyboard. It does add a little bit of weight, but it's not too bad. It's certainly something that's easy to throw into a bag or just carry around. I carry my iPad when I go out basically just like a, almost like a portfolio. Just keep it in my hand. Don't really have a bag or a case for it. And I know that might concern some of you, but don't worry. I'm pretty careful and gentle on my devices. But the keyboard works great. I like the cover. I didn't really like the little bump that it adds, because the way it works is kind of the keyboard part folds in on the side that opens. And so if you're used to the regular smart cover that's on an iPad, after the first little kind of panel or fold area, you kind of get this bump. And it does look a little bit weird. It also makes it a little bit wobbly if you set it down on a table on that side. I don't really like that, but I don't know how you would have gotten around that problem. I guess they could have made the back part the same thickness, but that would have added a little bit more bulk and maybe even a little bit more weight. So I think this was maybe the right design choice. And then a lot of people have also complained about the sort of origami effect in folding it. And it basically has two orientations. You can fold it in a way where the keyboard is out in front of the iPad, and that's sort of the typing mode. And then you can also fold it backwards, sort of flip it backwards, where the keyboard is sitting behind the display with the keys facing outward, and then the little triangle part is behind it, and it becomes a little movie viewing stand or like a tabletop stand for it being more in a viewing or reading mode. And both of those work fine. As far as like figuring out the whole origami thing, it is a little bit trickier, I would say, than just the standard smart cover. But, you know, I just pulled out the little instruction booklet that came with it. There's a little, you know, fold out couple page instruction booklet, and it shows you the two ways to fold it. And I was able to figure it out within maybe about 30 seconds to a minute. And yeah, there's been a couple times when I've had to fiddle with it a little bit, but the more you use it, it just becomes a natural thing. And if you remember the original smart cover, again, that took a little bit of getting used to figure out how that thing folded around and worked. The only thing I wish there was kind of an orientation like the smart cover has, where you can fold it in a little triangle and put it on a desk almost like an easel. And I know that's the typing mode for the current one. And of course, this has a keyboard, so the typing mode is the mode with the keyboard. But because you have the Apple Pencil, it'd be kind of nice if you had that nice little angled, almost art easel way of putting it down. And you can't, or I haven't been able to figure out any kind of way to fold it into that orientation. But the cover itself works great, just like a smart cover. Docks just fine. The connectors work in just fine. Typing on it, I already mentioned that a little bit earlier. It's great. It feels great to me. On a hard surface, it still is firmer, I think, than a traditional keyboard, or my Mac keyboard or my Apple Wi-Fi keyboard. But still, it feels good. It feels like you're actually clicking on actual keys. I think maybe part of the thing is it doesn't have the angle to it, right? You're kind of flat on a desk. But I have had no trouble, you know, hitting keys. I have no trouble in terms of my typing speed. It's a little bit slower, I would say, at first, but that's just kind of getting used to the keys. It's not significantly slower than if I were using my other keyboard. So I was able to adapt pretty quickly. You've got your standard keyboard shortcuts. Most of them work. I gave you the tip. A lot of apps now, if you just hold down the command key, it will show you the keyboard shortcuts for the application. And I have found those to be very handy. You still have to do a little more touching of the screen than I would like. There's certain operations, scrolling through lists, tapping on certain buttons and icons in a lot of applications that still have to be done through the touch screen. But even that's becoming more natural. As I use the keyboard and as I use the iPad Pro as my primary device, and I will say, I'll go back on some of my comments a little bit. I mentioned that I thought it would be a very unnatural action. And at first it really is, you know, to lift your hand up from one plane and have to go to another plane. It is very unnatural. It's not very comfortable at first, but the more and more that I do it, the more it is becoming this sort of natural interaction. So I wasn't sure it was something you could really learn or adapt to very quickly. I thought it was going to be a more arduous process, but turned out to not take very long. And within a couple days, over the, you know, past couple days I've been using it, it's becoming pretty natural. It's not quite there yet, but I think I'm going to get used to it. And so typing feels great. A comment that my wife and daughter both made was that the fabric surface on the keyboard, they really like the texture of it. And I have to agree, it's got this nice tactile feel to it. It's not like the smooth keys that you have on a keyboard. And I have to wonder if more keyboard manufacturers shouldn't maybe add a little texture to the surface of their keys, because it does feel really good to your fingers, almost like little finger massages as you're typing on it. But that was a pleasant surprise as well. I do miss the extra row of control and function keys, specifically things for like controlling the music, because I like to listen to music as I work a lot of times. So I'll have some headphones in or something like that. And to have to kind of reach up onto the screen and, you know, touch those controls, those manual controls, it's a little bit more difficult, but really not that big a deal. And, you know, that said, the Logitech ones, you know, that are kind of built into the case because it's a wraparound case, those were worthless. So you almost had to have the controls on the keyboard because you really can't use the ones that are built into the iPad. And you don't have that problem with Apple's smart keyboard. All of the controls and the connectors are totally open and accessible. So far, I'm really liking it. I think it's going to be the main keyboard for my iPad Pro. I'm going to look to sell the Logitech one, and hopefully I can find a buyer for it. I don't think I should have too much trouble. And that's it. I like the Apple Smart Keyboard. Oh, I guess last thing, it isn't really usable in keyboard mode on your lap. You can kind of do it, but it's really just not firm enough. It really seems like it's designed to be used on a desk, at least in that configuration. So that's just one other thing to be aware of, and that I noted as I was kind of using it. I'm sure I'll have some more observations and more information to share, but you know, my initial few days with it, that's how it's been going. There is a common question that I will get in emails or when people send me voicemails that is related to a problem where suddenly your Mac or your iOS device or iTunes suddenly start prompting you for your login credentials, be it your Apple ID or your iCloud login, what have you. I think we've all experienced this. If you've been an iOS or iOS 10 user for any amount of time, this has come up. And when it happens, it's something, well, the first time it happens, you don't really notice it, right? You plug in your password, you try to move on with your life. But then it keeps happening over and over again, and it quickly becomes very annoying and very frustrating to the point where you just want somebody to make it go away. You want to know what the problem is, and you want to know why it won't go away. And in the heat of the moment, it's really easy to get angry and frustrated and start blaming Apple and start screaming and shouting and wanting to reach out and literally just throttle somebody, right? All been through this. So I thought I'd share what I typically respond to. And yes, I have a text expander snippet for this to people who, send me those voicemails or those emails and things that over the years I've discovered and learned can help. There's some things that you can do. And the very first one is pause, take a deep breath, look at the pop-up message and read the entire thing very carefully. A lot of times when this happens, and I've done it myself, you want to blow through it. You're like, it's asking for my password again. Let me just plug that in. A lot of times you'll miss clues that are hidden right in the little text that are on the box that tell you specifically what information you're being asked for. And the reason that is significant is different things within the operating system are going to ask for different passwords or information. It could be your iCloud password. It could be your iTunes password, your Apple ID. Maybe if you're like me, you've got multiple iCloud IDs and iTunes IDs, and you get them mixed up from time to time. You also want to read through those things because it's important that you note that they're not fake, that they're not some malware or phishing request that might pop up. And that happens too. It's rare. One thing to be aware of in ruling those things out is Apple's never going to ask for your password on a website in a pop-up form, right? On iCloud.com, it's actually going to be a box that's on the page. So you're not going to get some weird random pop-up that's a web pop-up or a JavaScript pop-up They're also not going to ask you for that information inside an email. So if you're seeing that sort of thing, that's not something that Apple will do. So be aware of that. But definitely reading that little box can give you some clues and let you know what information is Apple asking for. And I'm talking about the modal dialog box that comes up when it's like, hey, we want your information. Sometimes it can even indicate what application is asking for it. So it might be the calendar app or address book or something that's connecting into your iCloud account, or maybe it's iTunes that's looking for it. And one of the things that can happen is I've known people who have really old tracks that they bought under an Apple ID that they completely forgot they even had, and they might not even know the password for anymore. But suddenly it's trying to play that track for some reason. Maybe you're listening to an older playlist. It's popping it up because it's not authenticated under that account, and it's trying to verify the DRM. Those old tracks had DRM, remember that? So that can pop up for that reason. So reading the dialog box can help you figure that stuff out. If that doesn't work and you can't figure out what the password is, simply trying a reset or a reboot of the device. So reboot your iPhone or iPad, you know, hold down the sleep wake button and the home button until you see the Apple logo, let it reboot. Sometimes that just simply fixes it. The issue goes away. Same thing with like rebooting your Mac. Sometimes things just get wonky and simply rebooting can fix things. That's just a good general troubleshooting tip. If you haven't reset or rebooted your device or your Mac in a while, try that before you go further down the path, because a lot of times your problems can just magically poof, go away during a reset. And then another thing to note is sometimes it feels like it's being really annoying because it keeps prompting you. Sometimes those multiple prompts are actually legitimate. I have this situation happen a lot with a MacBook Air that I own. It's a machine that I don't use very often. I have an account on it. It's actually used by my kids more than me. And when I do log into my account, suddenly it will start to ask me for my logins over and over and over again. And this happened a few times. And I haven't followed this trail yet, but I think it's because iCloud logins, the sort of sessions or the logins get timed out over time as a security measure. I think they get cleared out and they just need to be re-authenticated. Problem is when that happens, I think services like iCal or Mail, things that are using that login to check and update stuff in the background, I think they keep checking, and each time they check, it throws up a prompt. And then it just sort of backlogs all of these prompts. And so what I do is I just fill in my password for each one over and over again. And I've had to clear, you know, a dozen or a couple dozen of them, depending on how long it's been since I logged into that machine. And once I get through all of that, it just goes away. It stops asking me for the password again. So that can be a thing. Again, here, if you don't want to sit through that, a reboot could probably work because it's going to clear out all those backlogged requests, and then you'll just be left with the first one that maybe comes up after the reboot. You do one login and away you go. And then the few other things, sometimes logging out of an account and logging back into it can fix stuff. I've had to do this multiple times with my iCloud accounts over the years. Something gets wonky in iCloud, it's prompting me for my password over and over again. I just simply go into the system preferences, into the settings, into iCloud, and I log out and I log back in. It's going to ask you a bunch of those scary questions about what you want to do with your data. So you got to be prepared to answer those. You know, do you want to leave it on the device or do you want to just grab it back down from iCloud? But if you're syncing everything and you've got your backups, you shouldn't have to worry about that too much. This also works very well for finicky iTunes accounts. So if iTunes is constantly prompting you, just go into your account, you know, under the store tab, log out, log back in, and that can often fix a lot of this stuff. And then finally, and this one gets a lot of people, you know, iTunes has your credit card data on file. Typically, most of us have a credit card registered with iTunes. If that credit card information goes out of date, sometimes you'll get this login prompt that's like, oh, you need to update your account information, but it's not really clear what account information it's asking about. And sometimes it looks like it's a password thing. You might check there. Go into your account and make sure that your credit card data on file in that's associated with your iTunes account is all up to date. If it's expired, you might start get these weird pop-up messages prompting you for information. So there's a bunch of different places to start if you're getting these login prompts. If none of that stuff works, then you may be going down the path of, you know, reinstalling or at least installing over top the operating system. But I found through the years these, you know, what, four or five different methods will usually clear things up, and you can stop pulling your hair out. So there you go. When the Apple Watch first came out and some of the early reviews came out, a big question was, what kinds of things can you do with the Apple Watch when it's not near your iPhone or not connected to your iPhone? And early on, it seemed like Apple was saying you were going to have to pretty much have your iPhone with you to get any kind of functionality. After the device came out and when the early reviews hit, we started to find out that there was some functionality that could be used without tethering to an iPhone, and even some connected functionality that could work if you used a feature of the Apple Watch called known Wi-Fi. Meaning that if you had your Apple Watch and your iPhone together in a place where you were connected to the Wi-Fi network there, so be it at your home or your office or maybe at a public Wi-Fi hotspot that you connected to frequently with your iPhone, your Apple Watch would know about those connections as well. And because the Apple Watch has Wi-Fi, it could use that Wi-Fi independent of the iPhone to get some data and information and some level of connectivity. Well, I received an email from Gary this week, and he was trying to use some of that functionality at the gym. So he has a gym that he goes to, and there's a known Wi-Fi network there. And he thought, well, I guess I could probably use my Apple Watch there now and do some things like get email, send and receive phone calls, that sort of thing on the known Wi-Fi network. And he tried it out, and while the Apple Watch did connect to that known Wi-Fi network, what he discovered was that not every application or function on the Apple Watch supports that. And so he emailed me with this question about, well, what is exactly supported and how does this feature work? And can you give me a little more detail about it? And so, Gary, I'm going to try to run down what I know about it. I did a little searching around and even did a little testing on my own. And when I looked into this, yeah, what it is that the Apple Watch does have some limited functionality, but it is pretty limited when connected to known Wi-Fi networks. And probably the first issue is making sure that your Apple Watch is connected to a known Wi-Fi network. I know that you verified it, but for the rest of us, I want to kind of share how this works. So the Apple Watch's built-in Wi-Fi is only able to connect to the 2.4 gigahertz band of 802.11 B, G, and N routers. So you need to be in a location that supports probably dual band and doesn't have the 2.4 gigahertz band disabled, which I think some routers you can actually do that with. So your first challenge is going to be making sure that the known Wi-Fi network is something that your Apple Watch can connect to. And the Apple Watch, as I kind of alluded to earlier, gets its known network information from the iPhone. So the iPhone and the Apple Watch would have been, had to have been together, and the iPhone connected to that Wi-Fi network at some point in the past. And it has to be one of those sort of remembered connections that's on the iPhone. So if you ever went into the iPhone and told it to forget that network, you'd have to reset that up. And in my tests, at least at home, I had some issues with my AirPort Extreme base station that seem odd. Now, the issues seem to be related to just me because I had some other people test it and this worked fine for them. But for some reason, with my dual band router, my iPhone connects to my known network on the 5 gigahertz band. And when I try to switch over to just having my Apple Watch be connected, for some reason, my Apple Watch will not connect to that Wi-Fi. Now, I have a guest network also on that same router. And if I make sure that my iPhone also has the guest network as part of that known Wi-Fi connection, my Apple Watch has no trouble connecting even when the iPhone is off to that known network. So I don't know what's going on there. I tried even restoring my Apple Watch to see if I didn't have some sort of configuration corruption or something, that didn't do anything. So you may just have to make sure that somehow your Apple Watch knows to connect at 2.4 gigahertz, but it sounds like you weren't having that problem. If you do have that problem, I found some troubleshooting. If you're having trouble getting your Apple Watch on a known Wi-Fi network, there's some troubleshooting steps that you can take. And what they say to do is to first power off your Apple Watch. So press the side button, hold it down until you see the slide to power off option, slide, power the Apple Watch down, then go into settings Wi-Fi on your phone, forget the known network that you're trying to connect to. So you basically disconnect from it. Turn off Bluetooth on your iPhone. I don't know why they make you do that step, because I would assume that's just so you make sure it gets disconnected from the Apple Watch, but your Apple Watch is already off. But there's that step there. And then connect your phone back to that wireless network, and then turn Bluetooth and your Apple Watch back on and let the two connect to each other. And then that should reset everything and get the Apple Watch to recognize the known Wi-Fi network. And again, all of this should happen automatically in terms of it determining, you know, 2.4 gigahertz versus 5 gigahertz. And it should know it if you're using a dual band router, but I just found it to be unreliable for me. So I just wanted to point that out. And another thing to know is you may not always be able to control the base station, right? So if they've got the 2.4 gigahertz band disabled for some reason, I don't think many places would, but if for some reason they do, you may not be able to do the known Wi-Fi network connection trick. Now, that said, once you have your Apple Watch connected, now how can you test it and make sure that it's working? Well, the best way to test it is to have your phone and your watch together and then go into Control Center on the iPhone and disable Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on the iPhone. Don't put it in airplane mode because that's going to also send your Apple Watch into airplane mode too if you have that setting turned on. So just make sure you kind of disconnect the iPhone to make sure that the iPhone has no way to communicate to the Apple Watch. And then in the Apple Watch, pull up the glances and go to the settings glance. And what you should see, if you're connected to a known Wi-Fi network with your Apple Watch, what you should see is the word connected in green and then a little green cloud icon on that settings panel. If you have that, then you know you're connected on Wi-Fi directly to the Apple Watch to a known Wi-Fi network. And then the services that you should be able to use and access when in that mode are Siri, messages, and then I tried out weather. I seemed to be able to get my weather information. I could get things like time and clock functions work because those are just local functions. So obviously those. The activity application will continue to record data, although you'll have to sync that information back once you get connected back to your iPhone. And Apple Pay should work with any existing registered cards. But services, and this was something that Gary found out, services like mail or a lot of applications won't. And when you pull up glances for these applications, what you'll notice is they'll still have the little broken phone icon, or even some of the applications when you open them up, they will have the little broken red slash through it phone icon in the upper right-hand corner. That's basically saying, hey, I can't find your iPhone. I need to connect to your iPhone to get more information. Apple Maps was the same kind of thing. Although I think it did pull some cached data, but definitely didn't work with turn-by-turn directions. And using the phone functions, voice functions did not work at all. And so to get all of the connectivity, you need to have a connection to your phone. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be a Bluetooth connection, though. There is another kind of side to this whole Wi-Fi connection thing that is worth noting, and that is that if the Bluetooth is off on your iPhone, but the iPhone and the Apple Watch are connected on the same Wi-Fi network, they can still communicate with each other. And in this mode, you actually can get phone calls and app data. So this could be helpful at a place like the gym where maybe you want to leave the iPhone in a locker and have it connected to the gym's Wi-Fi, yet you're in a whole nother part of the gym with your iPhone connected to, or with your Apple Watch rather, connected to the same Wi-Fi network. In that case, you still would be able to get app data, make phone calls, do all of those things, because that communication can go over the Wi-Fi network. So that's kind of what I know about the known network's connectivity on the Apple Watch. Gary did email me and follow up and talked about the fact that he looked through the Apple Watch manual, which is available on iBooks. So you can go into the iBooks store and you can get all of the user guides and manuals for Apple products, and you can download those, and there's a lot of useful information inside of those. And so Gary was kind of digging through that, and he did note that there may be one exception, and I don't have a T-Mobile iPhone, so I can't test this, but in iOS 9, a lot of the carriers are enabling Wi-Fi calling. And it sounds like T-Mobile might have the ability within the Wi-Fi calling feature to add additional devices as Wi-Fi calling, I guess, endpoints or devices that are enabled to use the Wi-Fi calling feature directly. And it sounds like you might be able to add your Apple Watch as a device for T-Mobile Wi-Fi calling. So you go into settings. I want to say it's in phone. I don't remember specifically where the settings are. I should have looked this up. Sorry about that. But wherever the Wi-Fi calling settings are on the iPhone, go in there. And if you're a T-Mobile customer, it sounds like you can add additional devices to use the Wi-Fi calling. So see if you can add your Apple Watch there and then be able to use the Apple Watch by itself on a known Wi-Fi network to make a Wi-Fi call. Neither Gary or I had a T-Mobile iPhone to be able to test that out. So if that is possible, let us know about it, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and follow up on the next episode. But somewhat related to this, just another side note on Wi-Fi and dual band routers. On a Wi-Fi network where you might have older devices, especially 802.11b devices, just a quick reminder that those older devices can slow your Wi-Fi network down. Now, it's not slowing it all the way down to 802.11b speeds like some places will tell you. There's some people that say, oh, the slowest device on your Wi-Fi network is going to determine the speed of your network. And I think I've even said that in the past. You can probably go back and find a Mattcast episode of me saying that. That's just a myth. They will slow down your network a little bit. How much is really debatable. But a way you can get around this problem is by using a dual band router so that your older devices, like 802.11b devices and G devices, can connect on the 2.4 gigahertz band, and then you can have other devices connect on the 5 gigahertz faster part of your network. And so that's a way to work around this. And so you just need to be really aware about really old devices that might be on your network. For example, I had an old TiVo that had an 802.11b adapter, or sometimes older game consoles might be on your Wi-Fi network, and those can have older technology in them. So any older devices you want to kind of relegate to their own Wi-Fi network and get them off of your main Wi-Fi, either with a dual band router or set up a secondary Wi-Fi zone or something like that, just to keep speed going. But I had a question about that this week, and I thought it kind of tied into some of this Wi-Fi stuff we were talking about with Gary, so I wanted to cover it there. All right, the last thing that I have for you today, I'm calling When Mobile Backups Attack. And I know we've covered this topic in the past, but since I think on the last episode we were discussing freeing up disk space, I thought the timing of this was pretty good. And I have a new bit of info, so I thought the information was worth revisiting. And a lot of credit for this goes to a Macworld article by Glenn Fleischman that really inspired me to bring this up on the show. So I'll have a link to his original article in the show notes at mattcast.com. But, you know, Time Machine is a great thing. It's a great form of backup. I think it's the simplest thing to do. If you don't do any other backup, you should be doing Time Machine backup. You should be doing more backup, but at least a Time Machine. You'll buy an external drive, USB drive, plug it into your Mac. When it says, do you want to use this drive for Time Machine? Say yes, and you're backing up. It could not be simpler. And it works great most of the time, as long as the drive is connected to your Mac and the drive is powered on, right? Well, Apple thought, you know, there's probably instances when maybe you're not going to be connected to your Time Machine drive, but you probably still want to get your Time Machine backups done. So what happens if the volume, your Time Machine volume, isn't available? Maybe you're disconnected, you're on the road just with your laptop, you're not at home, and your Time Machine drive is at home. Well, what are you supposed to do? Well, Time Machine actually accounts for this. It does this thing called local snapshots. And if there is extra disk space on your internal drive, what it will do is it will generate your time, its normal Time Machine snapshots, and they're just the variable snapshots. So just any new data or changed data is what's being backed up. But it's going to create those snapshots locally in a hidden folder that's at the root of your hard drive. And it's titled, or the name of the hidden folder is .mobile_backups. And so you could go into the terminal and you could actually see this if you, you know, run the terminal command to view invisible folders on the root of your hard drive. And what it'll do is continue to store these mobile backup snapshots until the local drive is about 20% full. And then at that point, it starts to delete any older snapshots that might be lying around. If your drive becomes more than 90% full or has less than 5 gigabytes of disk space, it more aggressively removes those Time Machine local snapshots. And so that's what it's supposed to do. And the snapshots will stay on your local volume until you reconnect to your external regular Time Machine drive. And then at that point, what's supposed to happen is it's supposed to take all of the local snapshots, copy those over to the main Time Machine drive, basically playing catch up, and then delete the local mobile backups, remove those from your internal drive. And it does that by renaming the hidden folder to .mobile_backups.trash, and then progressively going through and deleting any of the unneeded files and hard links and stuff like that, kind of cleaning up after itself. And again, this is all great when it works, which is most of the time. But occasionally, apparently, things can go wrong, as they do with computers. And if the Time Machine drive that you normally connect to for some reason got renamed when you were disconnected from it, or if the drive disconnects during a transfer of these local snapshots back to the main Time Machine drive, or if some other thing goes wrong, it can sometimes happen that those .trash mobile backups, the ones that get renamed and are supposed to get deleted, they get stuck there on the root of your hard drive, eating up storage space. But because they're invisible, guess what? You can't see them. So if you've ever had the scenario where you're like, I'm missing, you know, several gigabytes, if not hundreds of gigabytes of free disk space, and I can't figure out where it is, this is a place looking, this is someplace worth looking into, is what I want to say. And again, I'll refer you to the Macworld article by Glenn, because you're going to have to run some terminal commands, and they're all in there. The link is in the show notes at maccast.com. And it will tell you what to do when you're stuck with these local storage backups. Basically, you need to go in and find them, run some terminal commands to actually remove them or safely move them to your trash and get them out of there. Of course, always make sure that you have a backup before you do this. And be careful when running terminal commands, because you are removing files. So if you mistype the command or do it wrong, you could potentially erase something on your Mac that you don't want to do. And Glenn does give a little bit safer way for doing it, where you just simply move the files rather than delete them right away. And then you can verify that you moved the right files to the trash and then delete them at your leisure. But there's also a terminal command that's in that same article that will allow you to permanently disable the local snapshot feature of Time Machine. I don't advise using it, because I think Time Machine is a great technology and I think you should let it run and do its thing. But if it really bothers you that it creates these local snapshots, there actually is a way to disable that. But I think, you know, the times where this thing goes wrong are rare. Oh, I guess I should also mention how you can tell if maybe you have some of these hidden backups is if you're missing that storage space and you suspect that this is where it's gone to, on your Mac, go to the Apple menu, go to About This Mac, and then click on the storage tab and then look at your local internal hard drive, and you should see an area that's marked as backups. And if that backups area looks particularly large and you have storage that you can't account for in that little section, that little slice of storage, then you may want to go hunting and see if you don't have some of these mobile backups that got stuck on your system. So that's how you find it. Again, I would say issues where these things happen are rare, but there's a good place to look. So with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of the great Smile applications at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're always welcome to email me. Send your emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And you're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Google Pluses, I guess we'll call that, I have accounts on every one of those places. It's usually MacCast, but you can check out maccast.com or twitter.com/maccast. The Facebook page is at facebook.com/themaccast, and our Google Plus page and community is google.com/plusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol. That's where you'll find me hanging out between shows. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.